So I mentioned at the beginning of the retreat that I myself did a few days of retreat last week. And even though it was short, and it was shorter than I had hoped because I got caught not being able to get to Big Sur because of the slides on the road, it was still a retreat, you know, and it still had the stuff of retreats. And one afternoon, beautiful afternoon, I was walking on the road towards the retreat center, and I was consumed with thoughts about, maybe I don't feel very good, and maybe I have COVID, and if I have COVID, I'll be stuck here because I really can't go to the retreat center. They won't take me in, but I'm not home either. I can't fly. I shouldn't get on an airplane, and what would I do, and where would I go? I can go to your house. I didn't think of that, Bob, but next time. So, you know, it was not being very fun at all. And suddenly I thought, you know, reminded me of those images that we sometimes see of the early Christian saints with all the demons who are grabbing onto them. And I actually looked one up on Wikipedia the other day. You know, they've got teeth and claws and they're holding onto them every which way. And I thought, oh, it's an attack of the demons, which actually made it a little bit better. It was like, oh, them. Yeah, right. Right. And, you know, every great spiritual teacher that we talk about has had those kinds of episodes, right? Jesus out in the desert, and more familiar to us, maybe the Buddha himself on the evening of his great awakening. And who comes along but Mara? And Mara is always the one in the Buddhist mythology who kind of tries to get you to do the thing that's not quite so good, a little bit less than. And so, you know, he was needling the Buddha, like, why be a Buddha? You could be a king. You could be a world emperor. That would be better, huh? It'd be way more fun, you know? Or maybe even a worse temptation. Who do you think you are? What makes you think you can get enlightened? So these are very familiar to all of us. I love it that they're in the stories. And we all have this kind of conflict, these kinds of obstacles as we move along. They often, I think, come for many of us as kind of thought storms. So you have huge moments of desire, something you have to have, or aversion, which in my case the other day was more like panic. Or maybe it's sleepiness that simply won't go away. All these different things that happen, or some obsessive thought or plan that you just can't quite get rid of. Now, in the Anguttara Nikaya, there's a lovely quote that I've been very fond of, and it says, "Luminous is the mind, brightly shining." So, you know, in moments like that, it doesn't seem really bright or really shining. And the sutta goes on to say, but the mind, this luminous mind, is colored by the attachments that visit it. And that in order to become free, one must cultivate the mind. So, luminous is the mind, luminosity of the mind, clarity of the mind. Is its natural state. It's its natural state. But we can't see it because so many things get in the way. So, you know, that evening with the Buddha, he was visited by Mara, and Mara shows up many, many times in the various stories of the Buddha. And, you know, and even they're mythic in a very deep way, but it's mythic in the sense of this is the way things are. You know, so Mara comes and he offers these choices that aren't so great. And then the Buddha recognizes him. And that's usually the turning point Thich Nhat Hanh, in his version of the stories, has the Buddha say, "I see you, Mara." And then Mara goes away. And I think that is familiar to all of us, that when we actually see what's happening to us, then it's less of a problem. What happened to my... Oh, the wrong thing. So, here's another image that's a little different from Mara or demons. Maybe a little easier for some of you. It's a bit of a story. So 20 years ago, in another month or two, my husband and I, who were living here in Santa Cruz at the time, purchased a home on the Big Island of Hawaii. And it's lovely, forested land, and packed with a lot of native species and a whole lot of extremely lovely and extremely invasive yellow ginger. And the yellow ginger was taking over. It was just chock-a-block full of yellow ginger. And, you know, it's new property to us. And so we settled in and we began to talk to assorted people as we spent time there. And we talked particularly to people who knew about the plants and the land. And we learned that the ginger was choking out a wide variety of native plants. And we were encouraged to return the land to its native state. So, you know, there's a lot of pondering what to do. We could poison it, but we didn't really want to do that. And you can dig out, it has these big corms that go down into the earth. It's very hard to dig out. Or, you know, we could chop it, which was what was recommended by a friend who's steeped in the ways of permaculture. So we could chop it and let it fall where it lay and let it fertilize the earth, and then we could chop it again, and then we could chop it again. So one day after I learned about that, I went out with a large knife and I began to chop. So our minds are quite like that piece of land, you know. And we are often, as I mentioned a minute or two ago, we're kind of far away from that naturally clear, luminous state. And I don't know about you, but my mind often gets filled with all kinds of weeds that come along that invade the space of the mind and the heart. And I liked it, actually, you know, that the Buddha suggests that we cultivate the mind. We cultivate, that we take care of it, that we have gardening to do. Now, another teacher puts it this way. He says, practice is the reconditioning of mental and emotional landscapes. So each of us is visited by Mara at every point along the way. And even as we wake up more and more, it's not like Mara gives up. Don't we wish? But it doesn't seem to happen that way. It's tough. And according to the texts, Mara doesn't come alone. He comes with his allies, and he encourages us to move away from awakening and to be less skillful. So it's said that there are 10 armies of Mara. The sense pleasures, dissatisfaction, hunger and thirst, craving, sloth and torpor, fear, doubt, conceit and ingratitude, gain and praise, and self-exaltation. So these are the grist for the stories that invade the mind, like the armies of invasive plants in my garden. So the first four kind of strike at our basic physical needs and our addictions. And they kind of push against our instinct for survival. Some of them need to be tended to in order to practice. So sense pleasures. If you haven't noticed, I expect you have, this is a renunciate practice. So each one of you have given up a week of your life in order to be here. And you've given up all of your habitual ways of being, all of your habitual sense pleasures. You don't have your usual food. You don't have your comfortable couch and your favorite chair, nor do you have your cat and your dog. And not only that, you can't touch the cat here, which is difficult for some of us. And you certainly aren't having any sex or music or a wide variety of things that we use to make our lives comfortable and enjoyable. So you've stepped well outside of your everyday world with its habits and the cues that are there for your kind of often unconscious behavior. It's actually said, I heard an NPR interview a couple of years ago, actually, that talked about how taking a vacation was a really good way to break habits because you step out of your normal everyday life. And I'm here to tell you, I think they missed the boat. You know, if taking a vacation is a good way to break habits, going on a retreat is even better. You know, and the longer the retreat, probably the better it is, because you can't do so many things that we just normally do without thinking. The second army is that of dissatisfaction, which can really get in the way. And I'll bet it's already here. This retreat, it just isn't quite right. You know, there's something, it could be warmer. It could have rained a little less on Sunday night. It could be raining more because you need it here in California. There's too many people or there's too few people. And there's just, you know, these ways that we kind of aren't fully satisfied. And at the same time, of course, you do need a certain level of comfort and ease in order to be able to practice. I often think of one retreat. Some years ago, I was at Spirit Rock, and I had decided I was going to do the Buddha thing. I was going to sit in the forest where the mountain lions roam, which would help me stay awake. And so I found a spot up on the hillside, under some trees. I was so pleased with myself. I went to talk to Jack about it, and he got all fussed. You know, well, was I comfortable enough? Which I thought was really interesting. Like, comfortable enough. But he was right, because, of course, if you're too uncomfortable, that doesn't work either. And there were a fair number of rocks in the area. So you need just kind of the right balance, just the right thing. But I think the real trick here is often we invent needs. You know, fortunately, this place doesn't have a shop. I know what happens at Spirit Rock is people end up down in the shop more often than not when they're not supposed to be there. And I know I've done it in my day when I've been in retreat centers with shops. So, you know, you go down there and you think, if only I could have just this little image or that perfect little statue or just this special book, and then it would be fine. Which leads us directly into hunger and thirst. This is a somewhat more elemental kind of thing. And, you know, we do have basic needs. And if you are needy of food or water or sleep or shelter, it's not going to make for a great retreat. And it's tempting when we go on retreat. I've had students who do this, who say, well, I'm going to fast for the whole retreat. Not a great idea. So I think it's nice to remember the story that J.D. referred to last night about the Buddha's own process. And remember, he went off and he was doing this extreme ascetic practice because that's what was done in the Hindu India of his day. And he stopped eating. The stories say he got down to eating one grain of rice a day. And it said if you grabbed his stomach, you got his backbone. And if you touched his backbone, you got his stomach. And if you see images of him, he's black and skeletal, really. It didn't work. It didn't get him the enlightenment that he wanted. And he already knew, because he'd grown up in the palace world of riches and food and indulgence. I mean, some of the myths about how many wives he had are rather astounding. I'm not quite sure how he did it, but, you know, several hundred of them is what they say. So he knew that that kind of indulgence didn't work either. And that's when he began to talk about the middle way, the place in between, not extreme asceticism, not extreme indulgence, but just right in the middle. I think of it as a balance point where we just get balanced with our practice. So then, of course, craving, that very, very large army of craving that can arise from any of the above. You know, we get attached to what we have to have. Think about it. You may have something you kind of wish you have to have. You may have even brought that something. I'd be interested to know how much chocolate is in the suitcases of people. You know, people bring these little things in that they have to have. And craving often always leads to suffering, not often, but always. That place where we just so want. I've heard so many stories of people like at IMS who crave chocolate and finally end up walking into town in order to get it. And, you know, you begin to see when I'm really attached to this wanting, I suffer. So the next three armies begin to come in, maybe sometimes as we actually go deeper. So, I'm sorry, I am not seeing my page numbers here. There we go. So one of them is sloth and torpor. Now, sloth and torpor, I've always said sloth and torpor sounds like a bad law firm. But, you know, we're talking about sleepiness, right? That really sticky, sleepy place that we all have. And, of course, it is very much around at the beginning of a retreat. We talked about it yesterday, you know, that as you come here, and particularly if you're tired and you sit down and you get sort of comfortable, and you close your eyes and your body says, oh, great, you know, it's nap time. Let's go to sleep. But it also sticks around. And so as you go into the retreat this week, this particular army may still visit you. And that gets interesting because really then the question is, if I'm overcome with sleepiness, what is it I'm not looking at? What might I see if I were awake? You know, what is here that I'm turning away from and I go to sleep rather than seeing it? So it's an element of the resistance that comes to awakening. And then, of course, there's the army, the one I had last week, of fear and anxiety that comes along. And that's interesting to see when it kicks in, because often it can kick in. You can get anxious and fearful in a retreat just when things are about to go deeper. And it can be, sometimes it's called the rolling up the mat stage, where you know, okay, I'm out of here. I'm done. I can't do this. It's too much. And the stillness of, and the awakened mind is more than we can take on. So fear is so interesting. And of course, it can be fear of outside things too. And fear is so interesting because fear is always not about the very present moment. In this very present moment, we are coping one way or another. You know, some Jack used to like to say, you know, if the bear has your arm, what you worry about is what happens when he bites my head. Right? You're coping with the arm, all right, but the head part starts being really scary. So it's not about now. It's about out there. It's a story. A little hard to remember that sometimes. I know I have a hard time remembering it, but it is a story about what could happen. So I like the image a lot of having a flashlight. And if you go out on one of these dark nights when there isn't too much moon, so you might have to wait a little few more days, and you have a flashlight, you can't see very far ahead, right? You can maybe see the next 5 or 6 feet if it's kind of a wimpy flashlight. And if it's a really good one, you might get 10 or 15 feet or maybe even 20, but it's not very far. And what you can't see, of course, is what's out there in the shadows and the dark where whatever it is that you're afraid of is lurking. And so the invitation is, and the way to work with the flashlight is to stay with where you can see. You stay just with what you know, just in our case, just with the present moment. And it can be so helpful when that fear army comes through to go, okay, right here, you know, I'm sitting here, got the Sabaton here, and Bob's over there, and JD's over there. So that feels right. This moment is safe, right? Next week, don't know. But this moment is safe, and to relax into this moment is really what we're talking about a lot in this retreat. There are 10 of them, you know, so this keeps going. It's like, oh my God, one more thing. So then is doubt. Doubt comes along. It's not working. I'm not a good meditator. I can't follow the instructions. I might as well go home. I don't know how many interviews I've had with students who felt like, well, maybe they should just give up and go home, you know. I'm not getting anywhere. It's the are we there yet kind of syndrome that you might remember from your childhood. So here's the bad news. There's no there there in a very real way. We're not ever going to tell you, now you're there and you can stop practicing. You know, I used to think that was true, actually. I remember once I said to Joseph, I see something and it's really exciting. And then I'm seeing that what I'm supposed to do is go out and keep on practicing. I think he rolled his eyes because, of course, that's true, right? You just keep on doing it. You don't get to arrive and be done. One of my teachers, I studied for a while with Hamid Ali up in the East Bay. And, you know, he has this whole system for waking up called the Diamond Approach. Wonderful, wonderful, very awake being. Some of you I know his work. And I remember him telling us one day, you never run out of things to see. There's always more. That's fabulous, isn't it? There's always more. So you're just waking up a little and then waking up a little bit more and a little bit more. And you're not there yet, and that's okay because none of us are there yet. We're all working on it one step at a time. So it's like a little like, I've referred to seed planting a number of times, so it's like that. Every breath of mindfulness plants the seed for more mindfulness. It creates the karma, if you will, for more mindfulness. Or you can think of, you know, here you are, each sitting is like time release medication. So you're taking it and then it begins to wake up as time goes on. So then the next three address the different flavors of the mind and the way that the mind can lead us astray, really. And the first is conceit. Now, conceit, if you grew up like I grew up a long time ago, and conceited was what you didn't want to be because it meant you were snooty, you know, and mostly it thought meant you thought you were better than everybody else. But conceit in Buddhist thinking is the comparing mind. So it is indeed, I'm better than, but it's also the mind that says I'm just the same as, and it's the mind that says I'm worse than. So it's that place where the mind is endlessly judging and comparing. You may have noticed that that happens. There's a line, I think it's the, I forgot which, sixth Zen patriarch, maybe. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. So that sounds like no preferences. Mm. But it really, what that's talking about is, it's the great way is not difficult for the mind that is not endlessly comparing. I also think one thing to consider here is this is the mind that isn't grateful for what is. You know, and gratitude, I think, often counters that place of comparison, that place where we are grateful for just, it's enough, just this moment. David White has a lovely poem. He says, enough, these few words are enough. If not these words, this breath. If not this breath, this sitting here, this opening to the life we have refused again and again until now, opening to the life, to the moment, to the breath we have refused until now. So then, right along with that, is gain and praise. We all want the gold stars, right? Didn't you want gold stars? I did. You know, you want the A+ on the paper. Getting a paper back with all that red ink on it was not a good idea. So we just yearn for the prize and the praise, and that whole place of praise and blame is really, really tricky. I was telling people the other night, I went to see Ajahn Amaro, who was my good monk friend who used to be the abbot up at Abayagiri. He's now the abbot over at Amravati in England. And we got to talking to something about this, and he looked at me and he said, you know, you're a C student. Well, nobody tells Mary Orr that she's a C student. This does not happen. It does not happen. I was not a C student. It was a disaster if I got that kind of a grade, and it didn't happen very often. So what he was really saying is get over it. Get over that having to have the gold star and having to have the grade. It's not about stars and grades. And when it starts being that way, it can really derail your practice. And then the last army is self-exaltation, which is that place where we do, in fact, disparage other beings. We're not only just comparing, but we're really putting them down. You know, they are surely less than. And I think it happens a lot in the Vipassana retreat world where there's somebody in the retreat who just isn't doing it quite right. My favorite story about that is that I was at IMS. I think I was sitting a month of the 3-month retreat back in the day when you could do that. And I was in this funny little room down in the basement that was kind of one, a single room, but kind of not, because the walls didn't go all the way up to the ceiling and we shared a common entrance, but we each did have our separate walled off space. So I kind of sort of had a roommate. So, you know, I arrived and things went on. And then I got a note that said, please do not zip or unzip your sleeping bag in the middle of the night. Well, you know, by then I was already old enough, so I wasn't sleeping through the night. And I did get up to use the bathroom several times and was like, what? How can I do this? And I had a lot of opinions about this person. To my credit, I also figured out a way to wiggle in and wiggle out. I tried to oblige, but I definitely had opinions, and I had opinions about her practice and how could she ask for such a thing. But I was only there for a month and I left and she was still there. So I really had, in my own heart and mind, put her down. Years later, I was at some gathering at IMS, some kind of a celebration, I think. And she was there and she recognized me and she came up and she said, "I really want to thank you for how considerate you were." She said, "I was very sick." She had come down with some kind of autoimmune disease. She was really struggling with trying to get enough rest and trying to be well enough. And she was desperate for things to be as still as possible. And there she was in a kind of sort of not single room. It was really an eye-opener for me. It was like, oh, I didn't know. I didn't know. And I had all that judgment about something and someone that I didn't know. So it's one of the armies of Mara when we do that. So these armies, they are the invasive weeds of the mind. They're just like that yellow ginger on my property. Sometimes they're very seductive and they can even seem beautiful and helpful, but they're not. And when they're there, we're not seeing clearly. And the mind is not luminous and it's not in its natural state, just as my garden was not. So there's a couple of things to consider that can be helpful. One is a very, very simple one, and I suspect many of you already know it, and that is the acronym RAIN. A lot of people know about RAIN now. This is from Tara Brach's teaching. And so if you don't remember anything else from this talk, RAIN is a good one to remember. So recognize, accept, investigate, and nurture, which when I learned it was, she had it as not identifying. So you can go whichever way suits your practice better. They both work. Recognize, accept, investigate, and nurture. And so this is the basic teachings of a mindfulness practice. Recognize what's happening in the moment. Let it be the way it is. This is the way it is. Great instruction for meditation practice. Have that little edge of investigation in the mind, and then be willing for it to continue or at least not identify with it. So, great acronym for what happened in my yard, too. You know, I recognized the problem and I accepted it and named it and learned about it. And then I began to nurture the land by doing all of this chopping. Actually, one of the things I love to think about, that became my work meditation for a number of self-retreats that I did there. So I would go, and every afternoon I'd go out and chop ginger. It's just the way you guys are doing a lot of work here. So that went on for about 9 years. You know, I would chop, and it would grow back a little, and I would chop. And then the wonderful thing about that particular plant is after you chop it back enough, it actually gives up and dies, and then it really does nurture the land. And gradually I found these beautiful tree ferns that we have there and mosses and a number of other ferns and native species that thrive. So I think when we are dealing with cultivating the mind, the gardening image is really, really helpful to remember. And that sometimes, you know, when you start, and even in the process, it doesn't look so promising, but after a while, can look pretty good. So the other teaching, the more classic one that I wanted to bring to you tonight, comes from a text that's called The 34 Wings of Awakening. And I've always loved the title, The 34 Wings of Awakening. Yeah. Isn't that nice to know? Your awakening process has 34 wings that can help you take off and help you fly and support your awakening. So some of them, here's a few of them. concentration, for example, is on five of the different lists that are in the 34. The 34 Wings of Awakening, maybe just to say, it's a list of lists. So it has, you know, the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths and the Five Hindrances and all of that as part of these 34 Wings. So concentration is on five of the lists. Mindful is on four. And then there's one that's called the Four Powers, which I thought was particularly interesting in view of dealing with an army, right? And so here's what the text says. It says, there is the case where a monk develops the base of power endowed with concentration founded on desire and the fabrications of exertion. This is going to sound a little obscure, but we'll get to it. He develops the base of power endowed with concentration founded on persistence, concentration founded on intent, and concentration founded on discrimination and the fabrications of exertion. So these are not really psychic powers. That's not anything that the Buddha's reputed to have had some, but who knows, you know. These great teachers have great myths around them. Even more recent teachers, Dipa Ma, who was the teacher of many of my teachers and some who are probably your teachers too, it said had psychic powers. It was even said that she could walk through walls. I don't know about that, but it was said that she could and could read minds and all of that. But it occurred to me that, you know, walking through the walls of the mind is probably as important as walking through any kind of physical wall. So these are powers. These are things that you can use to really deal with the difficult places in your practice. So the first, he uses the word desire in the text, but you can also think of it as zeal or passion or enthusiasm. What is your passion for this practice? I hope you have it. I hope you have it. Why are you here? What brings you here? What wants you to wake up? You know, that takes you to retreat after retreat. So, you know, when I think about my own life, one of the things I'm aware of is that there's been a thread of practice right from the beginning. When I was a child, I was a wannabe Catholic because I grew up in a very a-religious family. But things, you know, unpacked themselves as time went on. But I can really see, I'm 81 now. And when I look back, I go, oh, look, there was a thread that I followed. You know, like a trail from, and I'm still following it, which is good. I hope I do it right to the end. William Stafford says there is a thread you follow. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. People wonder about what you are pursuing. You have to explain about the thread. You sure do. I know that one. But it is hard for others to see. While you hold it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen, people get hurt or die, and you suffer and get old. Nothing you do can stop time's unfolding. You don't ever let go of the thread. You don't ever let go of the thread. So there was that. I remember when I was just starting to practice, I went to an event. I went to go to a workshop with Jack Kornfield. I'd never meditated before. And this was a one-day workshop at Asilomar at a conference, which seemed really safe. I didn't have to stay for a long retreat or anything. And my good friend Roger Walsh was there, who is a wonderful bodhisattva and teacher. And he stood up and talked about all the suffering in the world, which is a great passion of his. And he began to weep as he talked. And I thought, boy, I don't know what he has, but I'd like to have some of that too. I'd like to be able to speak about the suffering on the planet and weep. And then a bit later in my practice, I had some occasion to be present with the Dalai Lama when he taught and even in one relatively small event, and his passion also for all the suffering in the world. So there are these inspirations that really give us that passion and are worth really contemplating so that you have that power for your practice. You can remember, I think JD alluded to this last night, you know, how rare it is to have a human incarnation. It's very rare, it's considered to be, to have a human birth. You can remember how impermanent it is. You know, we don't know how much longer we have. And so using that to bring some energy to our practice, we can be aware. Merwin talks about in a poem, he says, every year without knowing it, I have passed the day when the last fires will wave to me. He has passed the anniversary of his death. That's true for each one of us. We just don't know it, do we? And of course, we're aware, again, of all the suffering. So that also can bring that sense of passion and enthusiasm for our practice. John Wesley, from another completely other tradition, said, it's a difficult world. We are here only for a short time. Let's do the best we can. Let's do the best we can. So the second power is that of energy and effort and diligence and perseverance. And of course you have that. And here you are at this retreat, sitting, walking, sitting, walking, working, eating, sitting, walking, back and forth, hour after hour. You have so much of this. I really bow to your perseverance and your diligence and your energy. And, you know, for the most part, nobody gives up. People don't stand. I've never, ever seen somebody stand up in the hall and say, okay, I'm done, and walk out. Now, this might be the first retreat, but I kind of don't think so. You know, it just doesn't happen. People, once they get here, they've got that energy and they really use it. And it flows from your passion. It flows from your passion. I like to think sometimes of, you know, you remember what it's like when you fall in love? I presume everybody in this room has fallen in love at least once, maybe many times. And there's so much energy around that, for nurturing that relationship. And so this is exactly what we're talking about here, is bringing that kind of passion to your practice. John Tarrant talks about mindfulness. He says, it's an attention so persevering that it becomes a kind of love, that in-loveness energy comes right into your mindfulness practice. You know, and sometimes it's very gentle, seems to flow along real smoothly. And sometimes, you know, it's almost like what I've come to think of as John Wayne practice, you know, where you, and you really buckle down and grit your teeth and you are determined, you know, I think I can, I think I can, I think I can, I think I can. Which, of course, is related to the power of intention, the intention that we talked about the first night you were here, of what is your reason for being here? What is your intention? And I invite you, actually, during the retreat to revisit that. When I teach a class at home, or on Zoom now, mostly, I always invite people to consider their intention for being there at the beginning of the class, because that's what supports your practice. And if you have a kind of a fuzzy day with lots of armies of Mara, to remember what brought you to the retreat can help settle you back down again. It's like setting a compass course. You know, okay, I'm headed south, and having a compass course, we're coming back to wobbling again. You maybe wobble off, and all of a sudden, instead of going south, you're headed, a little southeast maybe. And so then you have to correct and come back and be on course. And then the last thing is the power of investigation, of wise discrimination, of paying attention to your heart and mind. And I think of this one as seeing what works. What works for you? Not every practice works for every person. Not every flavor of practice works for every person. More than once, I went to Ajahn Amaro because I was doing some kind of interesting things, some couples practice and things like that in those days. And I would go and I'd say, well, I'm really working with my relationship as practice right now. And, you know, monks work with their relationships as practice too, but of course not intimate relationships. And, you know, I'd tell him a little about what we were doing, and then he would say, well, does it work? And if I said, yeah, you know, it's being really helpful, he would say, great, do it. And if I said, well, yeah, maybe not so great, then, you know, we could chew on it about what might actually be better for my practice life. Actually, mostly he liked what I was doing, but every now and then. So it's that place where we see what works. We're maybe willing to change our outlook. We're beginning to shift. You know, do you really, could you possibly get over your anger? Maybe in some situation, maybe that might be true. Or I have a really good friend who went on a retreat. This is some years ago. And she fell in love with somebody on the retreat that she had never spoken to. This happens, you know, we call it the Vipassana romance. And so she was a really experienced yogi. She knew that it was a Vipassana romance. And she would have these stories about what a great guy he was. And then she thought, okay, I'm going to experiment. This is very cool, actually. And she said, I'll tell myself a different story. So she started, she made up all, I mean, she didn't know anything anyway, so why not? So she made up a whole nother story about how he was kind of a bum and he would cheat on her and he would not be nice and, you know, all of these things. And all of a sudden the Vipassana romance dissipated and was no more. I love that story. I'm not sure. I don't know whether I could do it, but it'd be worth trying. So we experiment. We experiment. What works for you? Not for me, but for you. So my land flourishes. It's a great place. It's lovely. I'm so happy to be there with its native plants and its trees. It's returned to its true nature. You know, constant vigilance is needed. It doesn't arrive either permanently. If I walk away, the ginger will come back, you know? And so like that state of the mind is luminous and wonderful, and your mind can be that way too. So this can happen even to great meditators. So I want to tell you one last story. It's one of my favorite meditation stories. So this is about the great Buddhist Saint Milarepa. And Milarepa lived somewhere around the 1200s, maybe somewhere in there in Tibet. If you've seen a lot of Tibetan tankas and things, he's often green because he existed on eating nettles and not much else. Sort of like existing on kale, I think, or something like that. You know? So it turned his skin green. And one day he came back to his meditation cave. So you could imagine this for yourself. You come back and grouped around your zabuton are seven rather nasty-looking demons. And, of course, in the Tibetan iconography, those guys, you know, their eyes bulge and they've got claws and fangs. And so poor Milarepa, you know, he was just coming back to meditate. And so he said, okay, guys, go. You know, you're not welcome. And a few of them left. And so that was great, you know. So out of the seven, maybe he had four left. So he took a deep breath and he said, great, let's have tea. And so he brews up some tea and he pours the tea. Welcome. I'm happy to have you here. Stay as long as you like. Mikasa, sukasa. and three of the remaining four left. But the one who stayed was a piece of work. And he had, you know, he was huge and fangs. And so Milarepa stood up and he laid himself in the mouth of the demon. And at that, the demon left. So it's a great teaching story where sometimes we just have to lay ourselves in the mouth of the demon and really allow it to be there before it will go away. So a couple of final poems. Because you have what it takes, so here you are. Izumi Shikibu says, "As I dig for wild orchids in the autumn fields, it is the deeply bedded root that I desire, not the flower." And a person named James Charlton says, "Best spiritual practice is to drop the word best, the word spiritual, the word practice, is to re-enter your own garden, find each flower turned to the light." So let's just sit and breathe together for a moment. Don't adjust yourselves. Just stay exactly the way you are. It's great practice for being able to practice wherever you are. Just breathe. Luminous is this mind, brightly shining, but it is colored by the attachments that visit it. This unlearned people do not really understand, and so do not cultivate the mind. Luminous is this mind, brightly shining, and it is free from the attachments that visit it. This, the noble follower of the way, really understands. So for them, there is cultivation of the mind. So I thank you very, very much for your presence and for your practice this evening. Please enjoy your walking, and supper will happen at 5:30. And don't wait for me. It's going to take a long time to untangle here.